So P is what again?
Presupposition.
So this presupposition work, when you work it your way down, and this is, our society is basically not taught to think anymore. Generally, we don't, sheep don't need to think. And part of what I want to do is raise up people who are thoughtful about everything, reality. And so when you follow any belief system back to its root, you end up in this, the toddler test. Why? Because I said so. Why? Because if you don't, I'll spank you. Why? You end up in this circular loop, and it's called a virtuous circle. I'm going to talk about circular reasoning today and how, in general, it's not good. But in a belief system, at the faith level, you end up in this place to where it is circular. And it's only at the beginning, and it must be very tight. In a debate, I highly recommend it. Greg Bonson and Gordon Stein, both PhDs. Bonson is a Christian. Stein is an atheist. And they're going back and forth. And it's called The Great Debate, and it's about, does God exist? And you can hear the whole outworking. And I like debates because you can hear the back and forth, the give and the take, and to really be able to see. And Bonson, that's probably Bonson's most brilliant debate that he ever laid out. And he's talking about, he starts with presuppositions. And we'll see why that's ultimately the most devastating. There's an astronomer named Dr. Jason Lyle calls it the nuclear option. In a debate, when you go for presuppositions, because the nuclear option affects everything in its blast radius, which is all of reality. And when you go for that, there's no defense. There's no defense against a nuclear bomb. There just isn't. The presuppositions, when you work their way backwards, you end up with what are called self-attesting. It testifies to itself. And Dr. Stein brings up this, says that logic and reason are the only valid way to determine if a particular statement is true or false. And so he's making a claim, and
let's see.
And so once a person declares their ultimate standard, for the Christian, that ultimate standard is the Bible. Everything is measured against, everything that goes on is measured against a presupposition, and it's either conscious or unconscious. For most people, it's unconscious. You get in this discussion with somebody, and it's like you're talking on two different channels. You probably hit a presuppositional barrier because they cannot understand what you're saying. And it's pretty remarkable. My first introduction that people don't think the same was this book right here. Mm-hmm. It is normal, it is natural for every human being in every culture, in every society to think, everybody thinks like us. And they don't. And this is primarily between poor class and rich class. They don't think the same. My second introduction was this one. This went through the public schools really big. How to understand. And she goes through these poor, middle class, and upper class checklist. Do you have a favorite restaurant in another country? That's one that stuck out in the upper class section. The lower class, in the lower class one, the best story that's in there is this. It's got around that there was this family, like five kids, and they didn't have a refrigerator. And it was The teachers all felt sorry for him, so they all pitched in. They bought a refrigerator, had it delivered, and sometime later, a month later, and they were all grateful. They were happy for the refrigerator, and a while later, all the kids disappeared from school. And they were gone a whole week. And when they came back, the teachers, well, what happened? And they, well, life was so stressful. We needed a vacation. Well, how'd you pay for the vacation? We sold the refrigerator. That is a poverty mentality way of thinking. Money is for spending. In the upper class, money is a tool to get more. It's you invest it, you do stuff with it. It's your working money. Money is for work. Money does the work. And down here, it's we do the work and then spend the whole paycheck when we get it. So the shifting in that mentality is not easy. It's like, imagine walking into your house, pulling everything out of every drawer, every closet, throwing it all on the floor, rearranging it, and putting it all back. It's that kind of trauma. And that's why people don't do it. Maybe once in their life or when you move. But it is, if this changes, if your presuppositions change, everything changes. Your associations, your what you thought you believed, all of this stuff. And it's pretty traumatic. That's why it doesn't happen. And it's a conversion process almost to develop a new presupposition.
When do your presuppositions lock into your brain as a human being?
Most of us, they're it's like we're born into it. We're raised in it. It's the environment that we're
grow up.
Yeah, and it's not conscious. It's just, that's how I was taught.
Mm-hmm.
Without ever thinking about, well, why? And that kind of stuff. Traditions are really good at locking in mm-hmm. ways of thinking. And sometimes it's very destructive. People who grow up in abusive homes grow up to be abusive people. It's just that principle that gets passed on. Train up a child in the way they should go, and when they're older, they won't depart from it.
Well, don't they say that the children, babies, learn the majority of their behavior patterns to the age of three? I mean, it's like three or four,
and it's
now DNA'd into them.
It's all pretty young.
Yeah,
even
that's what I.
All kinds of stuff, and this part of parenting is recognizing how these kids are hardwired.
Yeah,
and then train them that way, and think until really 150, maybe 200 years ago, you'd go 1,000 years that. You know, I'm the son of a shoemaker. Who is the son of a shoemaker? Who is the son of a shoemaker? Who is the son of a, you know, back 1,000 years.
Did
really not much change.
So are you going to get into how to break presuppositions if you're trying to influence someone's way of thinking?
Yes. Being aware of them is the very first step.
Yeah.
Being aware that we have controlling ideas in our thinking. That's part of our... Let me get back in here. And this outer circle are reinforcements. If you believe certain things and there is no external evidence, then you need to reconsider what it is you believe in. So there is the self-attesting faith level. And God himself is self-attesting. It says in Genesis 22 that when he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself. That's also in Hebrews. Now this is in there somewhere. But this is the controlling place. And it's reinforced. Why do you believe that? Now we can, as Christians, we can start bringing in evidences. Evidences, and I'm going to, as part of science and part of apologetic methods, which I'm just going to touch on, and we'll get more. This is just the second day of four, so we've got ways to go yet. And I want to get ideas in, and then start bringing them together. So, evidences, you should have evidences. When the atheist does a debate and really going to be focusing on just the two worldviews. The atheist materialist versus the Christian. And so that's most of where the discussion is going to go. There's lots of subgroups. But this is probably the most dominant in the Western world. Mm-hmm. Atheist, materialist doesn't mean stuff. It just means all of reality is chemistry and physics. Naturalism. Material. There is nothing beyond nature's thought. And we'll get a little more into that. But this is where the focus is all going to be. So, from these presuppositions and evidences, metaphysics, which is the study of reality. What is real? And through all of these things, you go, what is real? What do I think is real? How do I know what I know? And how should I live my life? What's important? What do I think is valuable? Right and wrong. All of that, our whole beliefs about right and wrong have some very deep roots. That's why it's so hard to... And when it comes to culture, you hear the word cult and culture, that it is a locked-in way of thinking on a societal level. And when we hear subcultures and things like that, there are groupthink ideas that permeate everything. No matter what country you go to, no matter what tribe or language or civilization, all through history, there is this applies. From the deepest roots of what we think to then what do we view as reality? How do we know what we know? Notice that comes later. How we know what we know comes after what we decide about reality. Sometimes people try to start here and get to there, but it never works. It gets a distortion in it. And the example I used is that imagine you inherit a peach orchard from a long lost uncle. You grew up in New York. All you know is the city. And you get this letter saying you just inherited a peach orchard in Palisade, Colorado. For all you know, peaches come in cans, or sometimes you see them in the fruit section. You don't know anything about peaches, so you go there, you check it out, and one of the workers says, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a machine that could detect different grades of peaches, good peaches from bad peaches. And so being creative, you set out to create a peach sorting machine. And almost immediately, you're presented with a problem. You have no idea how to tell a good peach from a bad peach. And so you have to find out how to make a good peach from a bad peach before you can make a machine to sort them. This is the peach sorting machine up here. But you have to have some kind of standard to know how to sort stuff, what right and wrong. So I said, the ideas of right and wrong have some very deep roots. What we think is right, what we think is wrong. And so depending on where you start, you're going to come up with radically different ideas of what is right and wrong. That's what we're facing in our culture today. Radically different ideas of right. And they are absolutely sincere. I'll give them the benefit of doubt. They are absolutely sincere. They believe what they believe. They are true believers. And they absolutely believe this. And this other group absolutely believes that. And they are absolutely in conflict. They are mutually exclusive, irreconcilable ways of looking at reality. And it all starts here. Now, my reference to the tree of knowledge here, and just in case you're concerned about Genesis 3, you can go back and take a look at Hebrews 2, 12 to 14, because it says that we should be aware of good and evil. That it is a mark of maturity to be able to tell the difference. We have our peach sorting machine in place, and it's a mark of maturity to know that. So, philosophical big picture, metaphysics, viewer study of ultimate reality, and the word that gets used is ontology. Ontology. And that is meaning and reality. Meaning and reality are very much, the meaning of our life is very much tied with what we believe is real. And meaninglessness is huge. Epistemology, how do we know what we know? And there's three basic ways, and I'm going to come back to these not later on, but the first is empirical. I stop and look. Observation, scientific experiments, all we can use our senses to discern. Some people call themselves empiricists. I don't believe anything unless I can see it, unless it's been scientifically proven. I'm going to show a video about that here in a minute. Then rational stuff and think. We think about stuff. And these are two pretty ancient schools of thought. Plato was a rationalist. Everything we learn comes through. I'm sitting on my chair with wine and cheese with friends, and we're discussing. We're thinking. We're debating about how we know what we know. And you come to conclusions through reason. And a person who thinks that truth is derived by right reason are called rationalists. So people who think we can know that truth is revealed through our senses are called empiricists, rationalists. And then the third category is called revelationists. They think, a revelationist believes that truth comes from God, ultimately. All truth is God's truth. And that's stop and listen. Now that could be the Quran or, you know, a variety of others. And these two are subservient to this one.
To the rational?
To the revelation.
Oh, empirical and rational are subservient.
How we see the world and how we think about the world is subject to revelation. If you're a revelationist, truth comes from a source outside our senses and outside our reason. And then finally, ethics and values. What is right behavior? What do we think is valuable or important? That all comes later. And again, this is kind of the end of the line. That's where people get the most stuck. And they're arguing here and not knowing. They're arguing against the tide of thinking. And there is a battle. So, for instance, morality. Every human being has some kind of morality. From biker gangs to cannibal headhunters to corporate, everyone has a certain view of morality. And so the question becomes, why is it there? Why is morality a very real thing in the whole world? Versus, how do we know what is moral? And this becomes part of that presuppositional debate, is that if you believe that all that exists is rocks and dirt and laws and chemistry and physics and all of that, how do you get morality out of that? How can you put enough chemicals together and get morality? So we got a sort of controversy. Everybody knows morality exists, but they can't explain where it comes from,
why it exists
in the first place. And then, you know, Hitler was immoral,
had morals.
He was concerned about employees and people that worked in his factories and that people had enough time off and that kind of stuff. I mean, everybody has it, something. It might be different. You know, if you're in a biker gang and one steals from another, the thief is in trouble. But they just got done robbing a liquor store and killing the owner. It's a mess.
There is a morality. We are, and this is part of the answer, is that we are made in the image of God. We are moral beings. It's not that we have morality. It's we are that.
And so this is another part of the stage dressing for the debate. There's three apologetic methods, and all of these come from epistemology, how we know what we know. And the first one, it is empirical. It's evidential, sometimes called evidential apologetics. All the big guys use it.
Josh McDowell, evidence that demands a verdict. And it can be very persuasive. Here's another one. The invention of Christianity. This guy's apologetic is, and he goes through history and to show that Saul of Tarsus, invented Christianity. Now, this is real popular among Jews who don't want to believe in Jesus anyway, that he's the Messiah. So there's all kinds of... Here's another one. The history of Jesus. And he's writing as an atheist. So the miracles weren't really... When he cast out demons, he was really treating a psychosomatic illness. There are no miracles. In the atheistic, in nature's box, there are no miracles. There is no supernatural. Which will come up later on as well, that the universe itself, all of creation, is either supernatural or natural.
So it's evidential. And evidence is this is the weakest of all the methods.
Now this is, most Christians love this, but this will not convince an atheist in any way, shape, or form. Unless there's already some working of the Holy Spirit going on. Mm-hmm. If they are a committed materialist, this is mythological gibberish. It's just somebody trying to sell books. There'll be a cynical twist to it.
I'm just going to mention the struggle.
The case.
Well, I guess he kind of was questioning why his wife was changing.
Right.
So,
and so, kind of from her influence, the Holy Spirit was working. Mm-hmm. And when anybody opens up to the truth, and it would be, that's the same story with Josh McDowell. He set out to prove Christianity false. And it didn't work. He got saved.
That's a good way to have it happen.
Now this is 1801. Elias Boudinot, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He was the, whatever the head of the U.S. Mint is. I mean, he was as were most of the founding fathers were Christians. But Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, brilliant piece of work, but really argued and articulated well that America needs to be an independent nation and what that means. That's the common sense. We've got to think about the consequences here. What are we getting ourselves into? But then he went on to write a book called The Age of Reason, which was an atheistic apologetic, and it was horrible. So Elias Boudinot wrote the response. And this is 1801, I'm talking 20 plus years later. He didn't want to do it right off. And this is a very good both answer to Thomas Paine and defense of Christianity. The earliest one, which you can
get on my website, www.criticalmass.pro, is The Apology of Aristides the Philosopher. This is about 125 AD. Given as an oral presentation to Caesar Hadrian in the royal court when Caesar was visiting Athens or something like that. He came on a tour of the empire and Aristides got to present a defense of the Christian faith. And his is probably the oldest written defense of Christianity that is out there. And you can get that on. This is where I want to talk about, the case for Christ.
Can I bring another one? This is another guy. All of these are actually featured in God's Not Dead, number 2. All of these guys. That's why I got to put them. J. Warner Wallace was an atheist. He was a cold case forensics detective. So he would look at cases that are 20 years old and completely unsolved. Murder cases in particular. And he got challenged somehow. Take your talent, apply it to the gospel. And treat Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as witnesses that you're going to investigate the death, a murder, a homicide of Jesus. And he did, and he became a Christian. And he started out hostile. He set out to prove it's false, but the more he looked into it, the more he saw it. And they tried to bring up what supposed contradictions and conflicts and stuff. And he pointed out a couple. He said, this is part of what convinced me. Because when you're interviewing real witnesses that viewed the same event, they don't always agree. One will add details and the other will leave details out. And he said, those are the kinds of things, if they're all telling exactly the same story, we are immediately suspect of conspiracy. And he said that didn't happen. That the gospel, the differences in the gospels are what convinced him to look deeper. That there is something, this isn't just a superficial story from the past. Conspiratorial story. So that's his stuff. So, what is science? And I want to play. This is the movie Contact. Jodie Foster, Matthew McConaughey or something.
Yeah, McConaughey.
McConaughey. Okay, so they've made somebody has sent to Earth a signal from Vega, prime numbers. Started this big old flurry. They're at a Washington party, and McConaughey is used to be a priest or something, and he's writing a book. And